News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Whether you hear us on the AM side of your dial at 580, maybe on FM 1059, or perhaps you're listening online at kmjnow.com, you know that each week we catch up with veterans, primarily from the World War II generation. We want them to know how much we appreciate what they've done for us. We want them to know how much their service and sacrifice are still remembered here today. We want to preserve their stories. And along the way, find out a little bit about what life was like way back then. And we're in for a treat today with 86-year-old Ken Oliphant of Visalia, California. In fact, he's going to tell us what it was like to be a quartermaster in the U.S. Navy. Easter's coming up. He has quite an Easter memory from 1945. And he also is going to introduce us to a sound that if you've never been in the Navy, maybe you haven't heard before. Let's hear what a bosun pipe sounds like. Is your wife, Ladine, used to hearing that around the house?
No. She puts up with it.
Well, our listeners just got a taste of a little bit of the sounds that they would have heard aboard ship, like the USS Renville, APA 227, during World War II. But before you were in the Navy, you actually had a little experience as a high school student with the U.S. Army Air Corps. You were here in Visalia. In fact, I guess you grew up right across the street from your wife. We'll have to get that story. But in high school, you started working at Sequoia Field, the U.S. Army Air Corps field here?
Yes, we pre-flighted airplanes, went out there at 20 minutes after 4 in the morning, and were returned back to school at 8:30. We had done 5 airplanes. That was the requirement, and it was chilly, and but we did them, and it was something that they needed to be done.
Did your teachers ever complain that you were nodding off in class in the afternoon after getting up so early?
No, because in the afternoon, I had one period after that, and I was out for sports, football, baseball, tennis. Made letters in varsity in those 3 sports, so I stayed awake for all of that.
That was the old Visalia High School where Redwood is now?
Yes, that's Visalia High School.
And you live in a home here on Walnut Avenue in Visalia. When you moved here 6 decades ago, you were kind of out in the country? No neighbors out here?
No, there was nobody across the street from us for over a half a mile south. There was 2 or 3 houses on Watson. And other than that, there was 40 acres of grapes right across the street from us. That was kind of nice to have. We were invited to go over and get some of those and eat the fresh Thompson grapes.
Now you're making me hungry, and it is springtime. We're going to be seeing that pretty soon if we don't have houses surrounding us now like Ken does here. Let's go back even further than your work at Sequoia Field. I like to ask every veteran what he remembers about December 7th, 1941. You would have been a pretty young man, just 15 years old at the time. What do you remember about that day and how you found out that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor?
Well, we were in church when we heard about it, and I was delivering the Times Delta as a request for them. I had a paper route. I went out and we delivered through an extra for every house that was out there on the route that I had. That route was 7 miles long. Not many houses, but we covered all of that, and the other carriers were working in theirs as soon as they can get a hold of them.
So you had a hand in delivering that news to a lot of people around here. Do you remember what those headlines said that day?
No, I guess I don't really know the headline. I do have a copy of the paper, but it was something that was not expected, I think. When you're only in high school and you are not really sure what is going on.
When did it hit you that what was going on might involve you at some point?
Well, I was working for the Times Delta, as I had been delivering their papers, and I was working in the office in the evening taking care of any papers that were missed.
That never happens. I used to be a paper boy. I never missed a house, never.
Well, there was very few missed in one night. Probably the most I had was five. We wanted everybody to get what they were paying for, 75 cents a month for a paper. Isn't that something?
I'd take it, absolutely. So it's during this time that you realized you were going to have to put on a uniform and go do something?
Well, I knew that was a possibility because there was a draft was already in line, and I knew I didn't want to go for a draft. That's why I volunteered for the Navy right after I was out of high school. I left in June. It was an interesting experience that I had with that. When I went in to sign up, the Navy captain that I went in to see, he looked over this desk and he says, "I have never seen feet that flat. Do they give you any trouble?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Can you run across the floor?" Flap, flap, flap. "Can you run back?" "Yes." Flap, flap. He looks again and he says, "What did you do? Were you in a school?" "Yes." "Public or private?" I said, "Public." "Did you have to take PE?" I said, "No, I didn't have to take PE, but I did. I made letters, varsity letters in three sports." He looked again and he says, "Well, that's it. I'm surprised that you were able to walk." And he signed me in.
Were you worried they were going to bounce you for having flat feet?
I probably could have been 4F, but my feeling is if a person is working at something, there is no 4F. Everybody should serve the country. That's my opinion.
And you backed that up with your actions. They sent you to boot camp in Farragut, Idaho, and you didn't even have to spend a winter there. Lucky you. June to September 1944. Sounds like a good time to be there.
Oh, it was good, but it was interesting because it could blow some red dirt dust type of thing, and if you had your clothes hanging out on the wash rack, it would rain right after that. Now you've got red spots all over them, so you hope that you could get a release and get your clothes off of there if you had them, because they would sure look ugly with those red dots on them.
Yeah, and the ladies don't like the guy in bell bottoms if he has red spots everywhere. And speaking of, you had met this young lady, this neighbor of yours, Ladine. Were you corresponding with her during the war?
Yes, for what we could do, because while I was in the boot camp, that was all right. You could write home, and she knew where I was. But after we put the ship into commission, everything had to go through a censor, and that was, if you said anything, it was a giveaway of where you were or where you were going. The censor would cut that out and leave some big holes in your letter, so you were careful of what you said.
And you were pretty young. I mean, you were 18 years old when you shipped overseas, but had you thought about the possibility of marrying this girl when you got back?
Oh, that was probably a thought in there, but when you're still young enough that you would have to have your parents sign for you because you're not 21, though you could just think about how that could turn out. But we did do that, and we both had to have our parents sign for us. We were married. I was not 21 yet. But so my mother signed, and we proceeded with that.
Yeah, I guess if I do the math right, you were about a month shy of your 21st birthday. So you just got in under the gun. So when you joined the Navy, did you have an idea of what you thought would be exciting, what you wanted to do in the Navy? And how different was that from what you ended up doing for the Navy?
Well, I thought I might be able to get into the Naval Aircraft Repair. There was a school in Oakland, and I thought, boy, I've got this thing. I've got this experience in pre-flighting airplanes. I'll get that wrong. They don't fix you up with that. You just get another. But we finished boot camp, and we were assigned to a ship's crew over in Seattle. And from there on, I was fortunate to have been assigned to a ship that had billets for 4 rated quartermasters, and they only had 3. And they had me, so I was lucky to made quartermaster 3rd in 10 months without even going to a school.
And as a result, you would find yourself not too long after that trying to steer a ship in the middle of a typhoon. We're going to hear about that. And some people hear quartermaster, and they're familiar with quartermaster's duties in the Army, but a quartermaster in the Navy is quite a bit different, I understand. What kind of duties did you have as a quartermaster?
You work with the navigator and help him make star shots, both in the morning and evening, just at dusk and early morning.
You mean you guys didn't have GPS back then?
No, not really. With the equipment we had, you had to do it, and you had to have the exact time, and we would keep it. We had a clock that was excellent, but you kept a record of it, so you knew what you were actually doing with it.
And is that is celestial navigation something you had studied?
No, I just studied it with the navigators. We were helpful to them and they to us, so they taught us what we needed to know so they could keep up with them.
Just so I understand and our listeners understand, these navigators are going by the time of day and where the stars are to figure out where in the world you guys are, and they're telling you what heading to put the ship on as you turn the wheel and steer it?
Yes, they would, we knew where the direction we were supposed to go, and we would steer that ship on whatever they had planned for that. And we left actually in San Diego, and we were headed to Guadalcanal, and you knew what headings we needed to get us there on as short a trial as we could. It took us about 15 days to get to Guadalcanal from San Diego.
And you were going to Guadalcanal to pick up Marines for the invasion of Okinawa.
We picked up 1,500 of them, and they were there from staging there, and we went from there up to Ulithi and then up into Okinawa, and that was the plan. But as far as where to locate your position, sometimes in the morning and even evening, you shoot the first rated star, and you had to keep track of that. But there would be days that you would not get any because of clouds or fog, so you would just steer a dead reckoning course. And eventually we would find out that we are right where we should be.
I realize you had different amounts of personnel and equipment on the ship at different times, but typically how many people would have been on your ship when you were steering it?
Counting the landing crew and the crew that was assigned directly to the ship, that was 700.
It strikes me, had I been in your shoes as a teenager at the wheel of this huge ship, I might have been a little concerned. I might have felt a bit of pressure or responsibility for the lives of all those other sailors. Do you remember feeling responsible for them when you were in that position?
No, because steering of the ship actually was a very simple thing. It's you knew what the heading you needed to keep going in the right direction, and we had steering people, other sailors that were not rated, and they would steer it, and we would just observe that they were on the right course, and we would relieve them once in a while. But they would be on 4 hours at a time, like with us.
And we're going to talk plenty about Okinawa, because you certainly had an interesting perspective on that. In fact, you still have the plan of the day on the official Navy stationery that you saved from the first 5 days of that battle starting on Easter Sunday in 1945. But before you got to Okinawa, you got a little bit of an omen or a forewarning, if you will, about what you guys might face there. You got to see a famous ship of World War II, famous for the way it was attacked by kamikazes, the USS Franklin. Where was that, and what did it look like?
Well, when we saw it, we were in Ulithi, which is 10 degrees above the equator, and it's just a staging place. And the ship came in there with a list probably of about 25 degrees. And you wondered, where did he get those? They were up in Okinawa. They had taken two 550-pound bombs, and it just really damaged the ship. Where did they get that? And that said, oh, Okinawa. And that's where we were on course to go up there for the invasion of Okinawa.
Yeah, not exactly reassuring. Do you remember feeling anxious, concerned, apprehensive about entering a combat zone and a combat situation for the first time?
Well, I don't think so, because we felt that we were in the right position, because we had battleships and cruisers and aircraft bombing one side of the island, and we went in on the other side of the island, and that was a surprise to the Japanese, because we put ashore these 1,500 Marines and their equipment for 5 days, and without any extra kamikazes or being shelled at, or we were just in and out in 5 days, and we left, went down to Saipan.
Well, that must have been a relief to send all those landing craft ashore and not have the opposition that you feared. But I understand in those early days of the Battle of Okinawa, starting on April 1st, 1945, which happened to be Easter Sunday, that you saw quite a few things. The other thing I wonder, that we've got Easter coming up soon here. When Easter rolls around every year, do you think back on that Easter Sunday as an 18-year-old out there in the Pacific?
We were fortunate to get in and out, and it was something that you could remember, and you were glad that you got that part of it finished. And we took our ship back to the States, got some repair work on it. That was without any excitement. Never even saw an airplane flying over us.
But you could see from the distance some of the shelling that was going on in Naha in those early days of the battle. What was your perspective on that?
Well, we saw Naha on the midnight watch that I was on. Naha, which was the capital of Okinawa, you could see it was burning, and you knew that that was something that the Japanese probably didn't expect, because they had all kinds of tunnels, and it was a thing that we didn't expect, was these tunnels that they had to move their people in and out of areas. That was probably a lucky thing that we were able, though, to shell that, and that was a surprise to them. It was so quickly done, and so well done on our part of all of our people that were there, because this was the largest armada of ships that had been in World War II.
Yep, and the attack transport USS Renville was part of that armada. Our guest today, Ken Oliphant, was on that ship. We'll get the rest of his story when we come back. And before we're done today, I'll tell you how you can take a time machine back to the 1940s this coming Tuesday night. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 86-year-old Ken Oliphant of Visalia, California. You know, we're 15 days away from Easter Sunday now. That's my favorite day of the year. But 68 Easters ago, it was a very different experience for Ken, an 18-year-old quartermaster on the USS Renville, an attack transport off the coast of Okinawa. Ken kept the plan of the day from the ship, and if you take a look at it on our website, kmjnow.com, or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find that Reveille came at 2:30 in the morning that Easter. By 05:20, the first landing craft was headed to shore loaded with Marines. That was the beginning of the largest amphibious assault in the Pacific throughout World War II. 82 days later, 82 days, at the cost of more than 12,000 American lives, Okinawa was declared secure. Getting back to Ken's experience now, and those 5 days that you spent off the coast of Okinawa there, sending all these landing craft in loaded with Marines and sending all the equipment, did you ever find yourself wondering what the future was going to be like for those young men? I mean, here's guys the same age as you, could have been you in that position. Did you ever find yourself looking at them and contemplating their future?
When we picked them up down in Guadalcanal, you knew that they had gone through things, because when we put them on our ship, it took 2 hours to give all of the Purple Heart out to these people that had already been in a battle, and they knew what to expect. It was just a well-planned out landing, I think.
Well, evidently so, and that's part of the reason you're here to tell about it. Did you ever have any moments where you were concerned, where you felt like you were in danger and weren't sure you were going to make it home to see your 19th birthday?
No, it never really entered my mind. We were without damage at all, and we would have what they call general quarters at dusk, and we would withdraw back out away from Okinawa, so we were safe for all night, and we moved back in the early morning and unload again for all day and retire to a different place in the evening time. Never really entered my mind that we were going to have any problems.
And that wasn't the end of the war just yet. Where were you when the end of the war came, and what were you preparing to do at that point?
Well, we had left Okinawa, went down to Eniwetok and Tinian, unloaded some equipment there, and went on to Pearl, had some of our ship's repair work, and then we went to Richmond, and we went up to Seattle. Things that we picked up there was General Stilwell's black limousine.
So this is General Vinegar Joe Stilwell, famous for his grumpy disposition, I guess you could call it. And he had been so active in the China-Burma-India theater. And you guys knew who he was and what you were doing with that limo, I guess.
Yeah, we were taking it back to Okinawa because the invasion of Japan was going to be in November. We were going across and we heard about the use of the bomb in Japan, and two of those bombs, and Japan shortly after that surrendered.
Aboard your ship. And knowing what you guys are up to, you're headed to Japan to be part of this invasion force and land troops and equipment on the shores there. When you found out this war was over, was there a little bit of a celebration on your ship?
Oh, yeah. That was the best thing that we had heard for since we started into the fighting, because now the war is over. We had equipment that we had to unload, and we went down to Ulithi for a couple of days down there, and then went up to Okinawa and unloaded a lot of the supplies that we were going to use in the invasion. And that's when we got into the typhoon, and we had just anchored there, and they told us the typhoon was coming and prepare to leave. Any ship can set their own course and do what they can do to stay safe.
Before I get that whole story from you, I'm curious, when you say unloading all this equipment that you were going to use in the invasion, and you had General Stilwell's limo aboard, when you unloaded that, did anybody get to go joyriding in that thing, or what did you guys do with that black limousine?
Oh, they put that under cover as soon as they could get it unloaded, and that was a surprise to everybody. They didn't expect him to have that limousine there. That was his call, and he was looking forward to the end of the war, but they figured that there was going to be many, many deaths on each side. So it was fortunate to have ended in the time that it did.
No doubt, and I've read estimates about that planned invasion. In fact, one of our listeners, another veteran of Okinawa from the 96th Infantry Division, Mr. Burton from Selma, just sent me an article about what would have happened in that invasion. Of course, you famously heard that estimates of American casualties would have exceeded 1 million. And that said, knowing that you were part of that invasion plan, and not wanting to be melodramatic, but I think about the fact that you didn't get to marry your wife till you came home, that there are 5 kids, 7 grandkids, and 2 great-grandkids who wouldn't have been born if you didn't come home from the war. Do you feel like that atomic bomb and the decision President Truman made played a hand in saving your life?
Well, those atomic bombs that went off, it was interesting. They had used fire bombs before that. When I was in Japan later, you could see where the fire bombs just destroyed a lot of the country of Yokohama into there, and some of it was just flattened for many blocks. They did more damage than the atomic bombs did. The atomic bomb just put the fear into them. I have also the plan for what was going to happen in the invasion of Japan. We were fortunate that we didn't have to do that. We had carried troops down into the Philippines to be shifted into different countries that we had some Canadians we brought back, and they had been prisoners of the Japanese in 1939. In China, we went back to the United States in a shuffle of bringing these people back, and we got into a new captain of our ship. He had been a prisoner for 1,070 days in the Philippines. His first duty was to go to Japan, and he was over there to be in the trials against the Japanese. We were only there for a week, and we came back to the United States. And at that time, the war was over, and you had enough points, you could get discharged. And I was still shy of a few points that needed, but anyway, we got out of the Navy. I was not in, but for less than 2 years. So I felt very fortunate to have been with this captain, and going into Japan was something that was really interesting to me, because we met with this officer that was in there to for the trials. It was just another part of history right there.
Yeah, and as a teenager, I'm sure that gave you a lot of perspective when you see these Canadian prisoners who had been held captive for 6 years and I'm sure were just about starved to death, and then this captain who had been a prisoner for more than 3 years. What kind of perspective did that give you on why you were doing what you were doing and what others had gone through during this worldwide war?
When we picked up these Marines and others that had been prisoners of the Japanese for so long, you just found out that how they were treating all of the prisoners. And there's been many books written on it about, so it was a surprise to everybody that was involved, but we certainly were lucky to have had it end like we did. And they can say what they want about the atomic bomb. That sure changed the whole perspective on the war right there.
Yeah, changed your life a little bit too. You got to come home and enjoy the life you've had in the last 66 years almost now of marriage to Ladine. And I forgot to take you back to the typhoon. We started to touch on it, and I threw you astray there. So what did that feel like? Were you a fly on an elephant there trying to steer this ship in a typhoon?
Well, you knew what you were to do was to go across all of the waves rather than to get into the trough. And all of a sudden, I was steering the ship, and the waves changed direction, and now we were chipped up and nearly probably about a 30-degree angle. It threw all of the tables in the mess hall over against the one bulkhead. But the captain had given us orders to do what we knew what was right. And so without being told to steer a different course, we were to turn the ship on our own and get in there with you going across those waves instead of being going with them. And that happened again in about 4 hours later. And that makes you just glad that you were able to steer it properly. And we went closer to China. We were within about 200 miles of China before we turned around and came back to Okinawa. You didn't have time to be scared or whatever. It happened, and you made the correction, and now you're back on a course that the one that you needed to be on. It just happens, and it's so quick. You don't even have any time to wonder what's, you just knew what you had to do to make the correction.
Well, I'm glad you did it. And I think there are a few other people who are glad about that too. Did you have an idea when you got back to the States that you're going to go track down your old neighbor and see if she'd marry you?
That was my plan. And I had to convince her that that was the right move.
How'd you pull that off?
I think I had a lot of other helpers, and they convinced her that that was a smart move. And we've worked through everything since then, and we've had an enjoyable life. We're glad that things have worked out like they have.
Amen. And for us younger folks who aspire to a marriage that lasts the way yours has. You're going to celebrate your 66th anniversary here in June. You got any secrets, any pearls of wisdom you can share with us that have helped you pull this off?
Well, you know, it's a give and take situation, and you have to just do the things that are right to make the marriage work as it has.
Well, good job with that. I can tell by the fact that you've saved these plans of the day from your ship, those historic days early in the battle for Okinawa, the last major battle of World War II, part of the history you were involved in. You've saved all that.
You've got that bosun pipe around your neck on a National World War II memorial chain here. I get the idea that you take a little pride in being a World War II veteran. What does that mean to you? And what do you think those of us who are younger and weren't around during that time, what should we understand and remember these days about World War II?
My time in it was less than 2 years. There still are people who are wondering about the bomb. It could do a lot of damage, but with that, it's we saved the million lives of U.S. soldiers and sailors and Marines, and that was a fortunate thing, the atomic bomb that put the fear into them.
You've mentioned a few times here that you felt fortunate with the way things worked out for you. How do you account for that? Do you feel that it was just chance, happenstance, luck on your side? Do you feel there was someone up above looking out for you? How do you make sense of all that all these years later?
What did we have? We had some good leaders. And as far as if you believe in God and He was going to be on your side, that was the right thing for us to have, so we could look to somebody else to give us direction. I believe that today as well as I did back there, and I think that is what we all need to look at as what God can help with us.
Well, clearly he helped you with a lot, and you've helped us understand what it was like to be there in World War II. Ken Oliphant, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. And you at home, stay tuned. We're going to tell you where you can be Tuesday night to go back to the 1940s and enjoy some great music. Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I promised I'd tell you how you could hop in a time machine back to the 1940s on Tuesday night. All you have to do is go to the historic Fox Theater in Hanford and get in the mood. And we welcome in now the man behind the In the Mood show, which has been touring around the country for a couple decades now, bringing people back to the World War II era through the magic of music. Welcome in Bud Forrest. Bud, where did this come from, this idea of telling a little history through music?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. And well, I was in Washington, D.C. And in the early 1970s, I was the pianist for the Singing Sergeants, which is the official chorus for the United States Air Force. And I was stationed there just for 4 years. And then in the late 1980s, I had this idea just to sort of create a retrospective look back at some of the music of the Andrews Sisters. And so I started off not with the idea of creating In the Mood, but just doing some vocal performances with three young ladies doing some of the recreations of some of that great music. But then I got to Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, and I didn't have a trumpet player, so the next thing you knew, I had a nine-piece band. Then I added a male vocalist. So over a five-year period, it just grew, and in 1993, we had the great opportunity to perform on the steps of the National Archives building that closed off Constitution Avenue, and it was part of the World War II 50th commemoration activities going on, and we had 5,000 people show up. And there was a one long evening block party, I guess, and in the audience were a couple of people from the USO, and they asked me, could we go on tour in 94 and 95 as part of their commemorative activities, and that's what we did, and that was successful, so I decided to go out on my own in 96 and haven't looked back since, never thinking that in 2013 I would still be doing this, and it's just been a real pleasure and a treat to travel the country and internationally as well, and continue the great tradition of the big bands.
Absolutely, and it's amazing how many veterans I've interviewed that just the trigger of one song that they heard back then, that they danced with their sweetheart to, or that they heard after an intense battle, and it just helped them process things and helped them get a little taste of home. It's amazing how much power there is there. And I imagine you've got plenty of stories to tell from these shows of veterans coming up to you and sharing those kind of sentiments. Do you have an example?
Oh, the people we meet and the soldiers and sailors that fought in the wars, it's hard for those that did not. But I remember in Florida we met a Marine colonel, and I asked him where he had served, and he said, oh, I was one of those at Guadalcanal. Mm. And I said, boy, that must have been one horrific situation. He said, yeah, it was not pretty pictured. I said, well, after that, did they send you home? He said, no, they sent me over to Europe, and I landed on D-Day.
Oh.
You know, you just look at the guy still standing there, and you wonder, you know, what he must have seen and experienced in his life. And there's so many stories, but you hit the nail on the head when you said that the music really has a special feeling or experience. We all remember a place or a person by a song, and I think what In the Mood does is that it sort of captures that essence and the emotions that go on, the tears that flow, because of those that are still with us that experienced it firsthand, but even their children who grew up in the households of their parents who listened to big band, all the music, and the teenagers today, they're all into swing dancing. So I always tell everybody this show is for kids from 8 to 88. And just a funny story the other day, one of the friends of one of the musicians in the band brought their six-month-old baby to the show, which is, you know, a little young to go to any concert. But every time the trumpets were playing, the baby smiled.
You might have a future member of the brass there. Yeah. At 6 months old. Well, 8 to 88, you know, I think some of my listeners are above 88. You'll let them in too, though, right? If they're 89
absolutely.
Or 90.
We have, I just met a woman who was 100 years old the other day and still active as a 60-year-old person, and she was telling me stories about how she danced to all the great big bands. And one of the real treats for us as we travel around, we get to meet some of the original members of the bands. And last year we met Harry James Jr., and his mother, who was a singer with Benny Goodman, and she's 93 and he's 71, and that was before. And when he was a trumpet player with Benny Goodman, he married the singer, and but then, of course, they divorced and he married Betty Grable. But Louise Tobin introduced a couple of great standards there. I remember one was There'll Be Some Changes Made. And so to meet these icons and these people that really lived the time, it's been a real treat for us as well.
Absolutely. And I don't think you have to sell our listeners all that much on this idea, but if you can, give us a taste of what people are going to experience if they come out to the Fox Theater in Hanford on Tuesday night. What are some of the selections you'll play, and what's the
sure.
feel of
well,
the evening?
The reality is that, first of all, a lot of the music, the arrangements, were done by Vic Schoen, and Vic was the arranger for the conductor for the Andrews Sisters for most of their career. He went on to become music director for Paramount and Universal Pictures, as well as he was music director for the Dinah Shore Show. He had a three-page resume, and at the bottom, he wrote et cetera, because he was just one of those working musicians that most people don't know, but he did Maurice Chevalier's first American tour, and I mean, he arranged for everybody. His first wife was Marion Hutton, who was the lead singer with the Montaners with Glenn Miller. So to carry on this great tradition of the big bands, we include, of course, tribute to the Andrews Sisters, but we do a sample of a lot of the big bands of Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Glenn Miller, of course, and it's a musical review. It's a variety show. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes of nonstop music. There is no story to In the Mood, but it's as if the band is coming to Hanford in 1940, and I wanted to give a sample of what it must have been like to see and hear the musicians and the vocal groups and the singing, the soloists, as well as we have two swing dancers that bring down the house every night. So it really is from Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy to Tuxedo Junction, Sing Sing Sing, Chattanooga Choo Choo, of course, In the Mood. It's my hardest job is knowing what songs to leave out because it's such a wealth of material. But people, there's something in this show for everybody.
String of Pearls, I'm sure, right?
Absolutely. We do a little excerpt of that. And it's, you know, every year I change the song slightly, but the iconic songs, of course, have to remain as part of In the Mood. And when we took this whole show down to Australia and New Zealand 2 years ago, you want to know? They all knew the songs, too. It's I think their worldwide universal acceptance that American composers and lyricists really capture the essence of a popular song, and it really was a treat to be there as well.
Absolutely, and there's so many connections between a lot of these songs and what was happening in the world at the time. I think of Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer as something that was certainly inspired by actual events, and I know it triggers so much for the veterans, and it's so fulfilling and rewarding for them to do it. And I love the fact that it grew organically, that you weren't looking for a worldwide tour. You were just sincerely trying to honor that era, and the way it's grown is impressive. How long are you going to keep doing this?
If people ask me that question, I don't know. There's parts of it. We've played 48 states. I got two more to go. We're hoping to do some more international traveling, and we're working on that. And we just played up in Symphony Hall, Benaroya Hall up in Seattle, and we had several thousand people come to that. So for us as musicians and working performers, it's a real pleasure to be able to play in some of these great venues that are new, but also we play a lot of the great historic venues that were built in the 20s and 30s. And I don't know. People seem to want to see In the Mood, and it's a bit of history, but yet it's so relevant today. And I think a little patriotism doesn't hurt us these days, does it?
Not at all. Amen to that. And speaking of, I want to ask you about your connection with the Spirit of 45 campaign. That's something we've spoken about on this show before, and it's just an effort every year when August rolls around that we recognize the end of World War II and how significant the completion of that time in world history was. And you guys have a connection to the Spirit of 45.
Well, we were a part of that, and I think, you know, the real treat was to meet Edith Shane, who was supposedly, I guess there's a couple of ladies who claim to be the nurse in that famous sailor kissing the nurse picture in Times Square. And we met a couple of the gentlemen. I think there's about six guys who claim to be the sailor around the country. So it's, I guess, the one fell out in Rhode Island. I went to Yale University, had them do some scientific tests on his hairline and the veins in his hand and all that. And they said that he's the guy, but there are still others who claim to be. But, you know, I think that we sometimes forget that in 1940, there was only 130 million Americans, and 16 million of them were involved in the war effort at one time or another. And it really touched everybody in a way that it's hard for us today to understand, even though we are still fighting wars wherever, the numbers are not quite as invasive as they were back then. And it really was a different time of our country's history. And a big part of In the Mood is that we pay tribute to all veterans, whether it's today's veterans or World War II veterans. And the Spirit of 45 certainly continues that tradition as well.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great thing you're doing, Bud, and I hope you have a great turnout at the Fox Theater there in Hanford on Tuesday night. Is there anything else you think people should know about In the Mood and the reason you guys do what you do?
Just come and celebrate this great music, and we have 13 musicians from all over the country. It's a live big band and six singers and dancers that come from audition in New York, and it's all costumed and choreographed. We've added a fellow to stage and choreographed the show, who's a veteran of 10 Broadway shows, Alex Sanchez. He's not in the show, but he certainly has upped the production values of the show. So if you've seen it before, I'm sure you'll love it again. And if you've never seen a big band, this is the one to come and see.
Sounds good. Well, Bud, thanks a lot for your time, and have a great show.
Thanks so much. Look forward to seeing you and all the good folks in Hanford, and we can't wait to get up there and do it all over again.
Yes, indeed. That's this coming Tuesday night, March 19th, at the historic Fox Theater in Hanford. I know we have listeners all over the state, and there will also be shows later this month in San Rafael, Monterey, Santa Rosa, Redwood City, Lodi, Walnut Creek, San Jose, and Motown, Modesto. But if you missed those sold-out shows in Fresno this past week, maybe here's your best chance. In Hanford, Tuesday night, the show starts at 7:30. There are discounts for groups of eight or more. The number to call, 559-584-7823. That's 559-584-7823 for In the Mood at the Hanford Fox Theater on Tuesday night. Thanks to Bud Forrest there, and of course, our veteran today, Ken Oliphant. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.